stopped talking the last time you were discussing the day that Chief McCourt is retirement.
Yes, we had gone in to court to hand down opinions and then to recess for the summer, and as we were falling into line, Hughes raised his hand and said that there would be a conference shortly after, or immediately after we rose. Since there was no business to transact, we all of us felt that some unusual announcement was going to be made. So when we did recess and they came back to the conference room, Hughes took his customary chair at the head of the table and said that at 12 o'clock this day, I have sent my notice of retirement to the president. He spoke affectionately of his association with the court and with the present members. He said that he was sorry to leave. He said that he didn't feel inadequate, that he still could do a day's work as far as energy was concerned. He had no problems of health at that particular time that were causing him to leave. He had in the previous year been sick off and on, but he seemed to be in good health for a man of his age. As a matter of fact, Hughes was a man who could do in 4 hours what it would take the average person 8 hours to do. He had a so-called photographic mind, flipping a page and reading it at the same time, taking in its content. So all of us who knew him knew that he would be able to handle the work of being the Chief Justice for some time to come, at least for another year or so, spending maybe just 4, 5, or 6 hours a day in his administration of the office. But he said that he'd always had one fear in his life, and that was the fear, when, as he got old, the fear that he would have a delusion of adequacy. And he said maybe my feeling that I am adequate is merely a delusion, but to play safe and not to become a burden, he said, I have decided to retire, which I always thought was an extremely wise decision, because so many men, as they reach the advanced years, don't have that same discernment and lose that quality of judgment that Hughes exercised up to the end.
Well, in fact, he did outlive his successor, Stone, didn't he? A year or more.
Hughes continued on in Washington, D.C., in his home on R Street, the home that in more recent years has been taken over, purchased, I think, by the Burmese embassy. It was a rather lonely life. He had been very, very close to his wife, and they had shared many of his activities together. He was very, very lonesome without her, and particularly lonesome in the big house. He had a distinct feeling of proprieties. He, after his retirement as Chief Justice, he would not appear on a social occasion with the new Chief Justice. Not that he had any resentment to Stone, he didn't. But having been the head of the court, he, I think, didn't feel that he should now go way down to the end of the line and appear as a as an ex-Chief Justice. But whatever though, whatever may have motivated him, perhaps it was his feeling that the new Chief Justice would be embarrassed if he did not allow Hughes to protocolize, be ahead of him. Whatever the reason, Hughes never would appear on an occasion when the court appeared with the new Chief Justice to avoid any embarrassment either to he and Hughes or to the new Chief Justice.
Well, we could. You were talking, and this is a follow-up question on our first session. You mentioned the fact that Stone had held rump conferences. Now, my memory is bad, and I don't remember whether you said that he held these on Fridays just before the conferences, the regular conferences, or whether he had held these perhaps on Sundays.
In those days, we sat from 12 to 2 and 2:30 to 4:30. And as quickly as court recessed at 4:30 on Friday, those who were invited went out by car to Stone's house on Wyoming Avenue. And we sat in his library, and Stone played the role of an acting Chief Justice and stated the case, and we had long, long discussions for, sometimes 2 or 3 hours.
Do you think that Hughes knew about this?
I don't know whether Hughes knew about it or not. I don't know whether all members of the court were invited. The ones that appeared were Roberts, Frankfurter, and myself. There may have been some others. Black never appeared, but whether Black was ever asked, I don't know.
Fine, thank you. I was, perhaps we could move on to a somewhat different topic, but still related to Stone, Rugg, and Hughes. Before the Southeastern Underwriters decision in 1944, Drew Pearson again predicted the court's decision. Did this prediction, and prediction in quotes, further upset Justice Roberts?
I've been trying to refresh my recollection on those cases. There were several cases in which Justice Roberts became upset at predictions by newspaper men or others as to what the court was going to decide. I think I said before that predicting the outcome of a case before the court is one of the great indoor sports around Washington, D.C. It was when I was in the executive branch, and we had things pretty well worked out in our own minds as to how a particular case was going to be decided. When it was going to be decided was something else. I never had heard of any leak before I had come on the court. Whether there was a leak in the case of the Southeastern Underwriters decision, I don't know. Drew Pearson had announced that the court was going to decide in favor of the government. Before then, he had made a prediction, as I recall, in the Hope Natural Gas case. That was an opinion that I wrote for the court. And I think that came down on January 3rd, 1944, and I think his prediction was made the night before. I noticed in a book entitled America's Advocate, Robert H. Jackson, written by Eugene C. Gerhardt, that Gerhardt says on page 258 that the evidence pointed to me as the informant of Drew Pearson on the Hope natural gas case. Truth of the matter is that nobody knew until Monday morning the 3rd whether the case was going to come down on Monday. At the Saturday conference, Rutledge was still undecided, and he told me that while I could get the thing printed, he'd let me know Monday morning whether he wanted to write or whether he wanted to go over another week. And I find in my files a longhand note from Wiley Rutledge, dated the 3rd, the morning of the 3rd, that he had given the case further consideration over the weekend, and that it was all right for him, with him, if the case came down on that noon. So nobody was in a position to tell whether the case was coming down or not. So on the 3rd. So that must have been just a sheer prediction, because it was a prediction made, I think, the day before. As to the Southeastern Underwriters decision, a case written by Justice Black, a divided court, I think that came down in June 1944. That was the case, that was another case in which Justice Roberts was very much upset. He was convinced that in the Hope case that either Murphy or I had told the press or Pearson or somebody outside the court what the result was going to be, and he was convinced in the Southeast Underwriters case that one of us had leaked it. The misfeeling in the Southeast Underwriters case was so great. I think that was in the middle of March 1944. That we decided just to put the opinion in the icebox, although it was ready to come down. And as a matter of fact, we didn't hand it down for several months later, I think in June. But we held it not because there were still votes to come in, but merely to not to avoid giving credence to Pearson's prediction. Whether as Pearson had merely guessed whether there was a leak, nobody knows. I can't believe that any member of the court leaked it. Members of the court, in my years, have always been very, very discreet. Whether some law clerk leaked it, I have no way of knowing. But all of us, except Frankfurter and Roberts, were convinced that if there was a leak, it was not a member of the court. And I don't personally believe that that any member of the court did leak it, although if there were to be a leak from the court, it would probably come from my brother Frankfurter, who in those days was very, very active, very, very talkative, very, very much in contact with litigants, with the press, working overtime in all the social circles in Washington, D.C. But I doubt very much if he was the source, although it might possibly have come from his office.
I thought I would simply mention in passing a fact that I've mentioned to you, that on the 11th of January of 1944, after the Hope incident that Pearson reported in his column that Mr. Justice Roberts was, sputtering and fuming was the quotation that Pearson used about his prediction in the Hope Natural Gas case. So it would seem that perhaps Pearson at least had contact with someone.
Well, as to that, I don't know. It's possible that Roberts, in his own social circles, indicated his that he was upset.
That'd be very
possible. I have no way of knowing.
Well, totally different topic. You were not on the court at the time that either Justice Black or Justice Frankfurter was appointed. But you were in Washington on the Securities and Exchange Commission. Do you know anything of the background of their appointments?
Justice Black was at that time, namely 1937, probably the most liberal, I suppose many people would say radical, member of the Senate. He was a great debater, a great investigator, a great campaigner. He was very, very, very vigorous. And he had made many speeches that are a matter of public record concerning the court, the old court, and the way it had misconstrued the Constitution, the way it sat as a super legislature. Roosevelt had suffered his great political defeat, probably his greatest in his career, when the court plan, the so-called court packing plan that he and Homer Cummings worked out, or actually that Homer Cummings thought up and sold to Roosevelt. And that defeat was obvious by the summer of 1937. It was obvious that he was not going to get the enlargement of the court. And then it was that Vannevar retired from the court, leaving a vacancy. What Roosevelt decided to do was to make an appointment to the court that would, in the eyes of the conservative, old-line, reactionary members of the court, be the worst possible appointment that they could conceive of. So they took this fiery, so-called radical senator, Hugo Black. It was like throwing a tiger into the arena with these old timers, because Roosevelt felt that Black was their equal, that Black would make life miserable for them, and that Black would carry on inside the court the great tradition of liberalism that he had built up on the outside. It was, in a way, I suppose you'd say it was a manifestation of Roosevelt's sadistic side. He did have a sadistic side to him. Everybody does. At the same time, he was looking for a man who unmistakably would champion the kind of regime of political thought that Roosevelt himself believed in. And so it was that Hugo Black, out of the mixture of those two motives of Roosevelt, met the requirements and was appointed.
I know but in some of the accounts of Black's appointment, there is a mixed opinion, depending on who writes the account, as to whether or not Roosevelt knew that Black had once been a member of the Klan. Some writers say Roosevelt did not know. Roosevelt himself claimed not to know, but several writers have doubted that he didn't know this. Others have accepted Roosevelt's statement and said that he had no knowledge. Do you have any opinion?
I have no information on it. I never talked to Roosevelt about it, nor did I ever talk to Black about it, nor to any member of Black's family. I just don't know. I have no information.
How about Frankfurter's appointment? You again were in Washington at this time.
Frankfurter was Roosevelt's third appointment to the court. The second was Stanley Reed, who had been Solicitor General, who had argued so many of the so-called New Deal cases before the court. And Frankfurter was Roosevelt's acquaintance, if not a friend. Roosevelt had known him for some time, and he had a impression that Frankfurter was another Hugo Black, that he was a what Roosevelt used to call the flaming liberal, who would carry on in the great liberal tradition. Washington, D.C. Was very, very much excited at that news of that appointment. Harold Ickes, who had not, as of that time, been disillusioned about Frankfurter, sent out a call for a big celebration, and it was held in Ickes, in the Department of the Interior, in one of Ickes' entertainment rooms. I remember that Ben Cohen was there, Marguerite Lahand was there in the White House, Harry Hopkins. I was there, I forget how many others, three or four others. And Ickes had ordered up champagne, and the bottles were opened, and the toasts were made, and glasses raised. I remember Harry Hopkins saying that this was the greatest thing that Roosevelt had done, because with Frankfurter on the court, the Roosevelt philosophy would be a continuing influence in the life of the nation for decades after Roosevelt's death. Hopkins, I don't think, lived long enough to realize that the Frankfurter appointment was, while an appointment of a very highly qualified man, was not the appointment of the type of a man that Roosevelt had in mind, and was not the type of a man that Ickes had in mind. Before Ickes died, he was completely disillusioned that he and Frankfurter became very bitter opponents, very bitter enemies, hardly speaking to each other. But the Frankfurter reputation was one that had been made, I think, largely in the Sacco Vanzetti case, where he did a very stout-hearted job in defending from a public platform and in a book two men who I think went to their death unjustly.
Ickes, I believe, in his diaries says that Stone probably was the principal influence on Roosevelt in appointing Frankfurter. Does this ring a bell with you?
I would doubt very much if Stone was much consulted by Roosevelt. I wouldn't say never consulted. Stone would not be the type of man that Roosevelt would be talking to about an appointment at that particular time. Frankfurter had many friends in the White House. He and Harry Hopkins, he and Ickes were very close, and it may very well be that Harold Ickes or Harry Hopkins got Stone to telephone Roosevelt or go over and see Roosevelt or write Roosevelt a note saying Frankfurter would be a fine appointment.
I would have thought that people like Tom Corker and Ben Cohen, who would probably have been very friendly toward Frankfurter at this time, would have been much closer to Roosevelt.
Yes, I think the driving power came from that small group of Ickes, Hopkins, Tommy Corcoran and Ben Cohen, rather than from Stone. I think that they probably did put on some layers of recommendations, but I don't think Stone would initiate that.
Well, speaking of your pre-court days, when you came to the SEC, you worked closely with Joseph Kennedy. How were your relations with him, and what sort of man was he, and how did he get along with new dealers like Tom Corcoran or Ben Cohen or Eccles?
Well, Joseph P. Kennedy, at that time, 1933, 1934, was at his prime. He had made a considerable fortune. He was a man of brilliant energy, and he was a Democrat. He was very much for Roosevelt. I think he was bored with business, and he came on to Washington to head up the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was organized in 1934. The Securities Act of 1933 originally was administered by the Federal Trade Commission. 1934, when the Securities and Exchange Commission was formed, the enforcement of the 33 Act was transferred to the new commission. And some of the, from the Federal Trade Commission came over to become commissioners. Robert Healy, George Matthews, and Jim Landis. I think there was one other member of the commission in addition to Kennedy. I think it was Ross, the public power man from the state of Washington. Well, anyway, or it might have been Pecora, Ferdinand Pecora. Kennedy was organizing the commission, and I had done quite a lot of field work in bankruptcies and in receiverships. I had published quite a lot about bankruptcies and receiverships and protective committees. I had never known Kennedy, but I got word in New Haven, where I was then teaching, that he wanted to see me. So I came to Washington, and he asked me to head up what we would call a bureau or a branch of the SEC, dealing with protective committees, the initial job being to make an investigation and write a report and submit it to Congress pursuant to a statutory provision that had been written into the Securities Act of 1934. So I got leave of absence from Yale, and I reported in October or September 1934, thinking that it would be a job that could be accomplished in one semester of an academic year. Before that semester had passed, I got an extension of time from Yale because I was nowhere near finished, and then planned to finish by the summer of 1935. Got another extension of time from Yale. I forget exact time when Joe Kennedy left the SEC. He went from chairmanship of the SEC over to the Maritime Commission, and he was succeeded as chairman of the SEC by Jim Landis. And I think it was in the winter of 35 and 36. Kennedy wasn't very long at the SEC. But we got to be very close friends. We worked together. He was a two-fisted, tough, hard-driving administrator. He backed up his subordinates. I found that he was a very fine man to work with in harness, so to speak. Joe Kennedy, before he left, or right after he left, got Roosevelt to name me as a commissioner to fill a vacancy. And I believe that was the beginning of 1936, and the report to Congress was still not finished, so I got another extension of time from Yale down to that would carry me through the summer of 1936. I got still another extension of time, this time a year, I believe, from Yale, because the while most of the field work had been done, the writing of a report turned out to be about 8 volumes. It was quite a task, in the drafting of legislation and so on. But anyway, in the another year, at the beginning of 1937, I was visited by a committee of the faculty of the Yale Law School, and they wanted me to come back to Yale and to be dean of the Yale Law School, an idea that had a lot of attraction to me. And I had planned to leave in the summer sometime, or late summer, early fall of 1937. In the meantime, that is between the first of 1937 and the late summer of 1937, there had developed inside the commission a great controversy as to what the attitude of the commission to the stock exchanges was going to be, and to the other security markets. There was a one group that was anxious for very moderate action. I was in a group that thought we should make some rather radical changes, clean house, make the stock exchange more of a public institution than a private club, and so on. As that controversy developed, in Washington, D.C., the members of the Roosevelt family, so to speak, I don't mean his personal family, but the political family, became divided, and feelings ran very high. And many of them wanted me to stay on. And I finally agreed that I would stay on, provided that I was made chairman. But the other group that was opposed to this reform movement vis-a-vis the stock exchanges and security markets was headed by Jim Landis. And the last thing that Jim Landis wanted was for me to become chairman of the SEC, because then the cause that he had espoused would lose out. And so this became somewhat of a contest, whether because Jim was leaving to become dean of the Harvard Law School. And everybody thought he would leave in the summer, but he didn't leave. Everybody thought he'd leave the 1st of September. He didn't leave. And Harvard was about to open, and he still didn't leave. And the obvious strategy was to get me to go back to Yale before he went to Harvard. It was sort of a waiting game. And finally, my time was out, and I had to go back. And so I got a hold of Joe Kennedy at the Maritime Commission and told him what the score was. We talked about it, and I said, I'm leaving at 10 o'clock in the morning. I was staying, I think, at the Cosmos Club at the time, and I got up and had breakfast and had my bag packed. I was about to leave the room when there was a telephone call from Joe Kennedy, saying that he'd been over talking to Roosevelt and for me to stand by in the room because he thought that Roosevelt would be calling me in a few minutes and that I would not be leaving town. Well, in 5 or 10 minutes, Roosevelt did call, and in his most gracious way told me that he was announcing that I had been chosen as the new chairman of the SEC. So it was. Those are the early associations I'd had with Joe Kennedy. He was often thought of as a symbol of the wolf of Wall Street, and so on. But he knew the problem. He knew what should be done. And but for Joe Kennedy, I would have caught the train to New Haven and have put the Washington, D.C. and the New Deal behind me, and probably never would have returned and have led out a very peaceful life as dean of the Yale Law School.
Probably sometimes you have regrets. May I ask on this, do you know how Kennedy got along with people like Corcoran and Ben Cohen?
Oh, just fine. They were all very, very close. They were very intimate. They were a very good team.
In your work, did you get to know Myrna Eccles very well when you were on the commission?
Yes. I knew Mariner. He was, in those days, he was a very difficult man to talk to because he did all the talking. I remember many times being sent over by Roosevelt on missions to get Mariner to do so-and-so, but at the end of an hour and a half or 2 hours, Mariner would still be talking. He was a very fine person. He was very difficult in an administrative setup because he wasn't a man who was subject to much control even by Roosevelt. was somewhat the same. Jesse was a sort of an empire builder. He did a fine job as banker. He was honest as the day is long, and very, very, very independent of Roosevelt. I remember one time Roosevelt called me and said that he'd been having trouble with Jesse, and would I get Jesse over sometime so that the three of us could have a talk about this matter. So we worked it out, and Jesse and I appeared, and for 30 minutes Roosevelt talked and delivered a sort of a sermon and laid down a directive to Jesse Jones, and turned to me and said, "Well, I hope that you can see to it that this thing is done." So Jesse and I walked out of the White House, and Jesse had his big black limousine to get into, and before I get in, I said, "Jesse, when are we going to have another conference about this?" He said, "We're not." And I said, "Well, you heard what the president said." Jesse took off his hat, and pointing to his gray hair, he said, "Young man," he said, "when your hair gets the color of mine, you will have more wisdom, I hope, than you have today, or that you show today." And I said, "What do you mean by that, Jesse?" And he said, "When you're around Washington a while with Roosevelt, you'll realize that he's so busy doing so many things that he never can possibly catch up with the thing that he tells me to do today. So we'll just forget about it." So it was buried, and Jesse was right, and Roosevelt was too.